Savior, may I learn to love thee, walk the path that thou hast shown. Pause to help and lift another, finding strength beyond my own.
Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at GayMormonStories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
So I continued to attend and basically sit on the back bench, and there were some people that were friendly, and I became ward organist, as I often was. And so I made some friends in the ward that way. But I could tell there's a lot of socializing and a lot of stuff going on in the ward that I just was never included in. And I would just sit on the back bench on the Sundays when I wasn't playing, and playing the organ, and then I'd go home, and and that was that. And the divorce was very, very hard to deal with, because it was a permanent change in my status within the church, and I knew that it would disqualify me from certain areas of service, and it was difficult to deal with. And then one Sunday, I think it was in June or July of 2008, I sat in sacrament meeting, and the bishop got up and he read a letter from the First Presidency asking that everyone support the Yes on Proposition 8 campaign with their time and their talents and their money and all the rest of that. And that was proved to be one of the major turning points of my life, was that day. Because I recognized in the wording of that letter references to one of the covenants in the temple, the law of consecration, which I had heard obviously countless times.
Yeah.
And I knew that all the endowed members in California would hear it the same way. This was the prophet summoning them to make good on their oath to consecrate to the church, not to God, but to the church. That's what the oath says. Their time and their talents and their means and everything with which the Lord has blessed them to support the Yes on Proposition 8 campaign. Well, when I first heard of the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruling that marriage equality was in fact required by the equal protection provisions of the Massachusetts state constitution, initially I thought, oh, this can't be right. This is just judicial activism. My family had always been very conservative Republican. That was the atmosphere I was raised in. And so I read National Review and watched Fox News and all this stuff. So that was the mindset that I had. And this is this horrible judicial activism and perversion of the family. The script was sort of automatic for me. And so I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it. But sort of in the back of my mind, in that little bit of compartmentalized, part of that I had been hiding for so long, I thought, wow, isn't that interesting? And I sort of started getting a little bit more curious about it.
But you had gone through Prop 22, right?
Oh, I was away in school, or I wasn't in California then.
Okay.
I don't remember when that was, but I remember hearing about it, and I studied it later, and I remember reading that Proposition 8 was exactly the same wording as Proposition 22, except that it was just going to put it into the Constitution rather than as a state statute.
Yeah.
You know, and as an attorney, of course, I knew the difference, and I knew why that was really a very important distinction. And so that made sense to me. So when I heard the bishop read that letter from the First Presidency, I was really, really astonished because in my first law firm, I had done some legal work for the church as outside counsel, and I knew the rules for the church's involvement in politics. It was basically, we don't do it unless it's a moral issue. And then I realized, well, I guess they figured this is a moral issue. And so I just sort of watched and waited to see what would happen. And I was just amazed to watch what happened to my ward in Stake. I live in a ward in Stake that's fairly prosperous. And so it was like every Sunday turned into a political action committee meeting. There were lists for precinct walks and excursions to this place or that place or participating in this public forum or that outreach meeting or whatever. You know, these lists were going up and down the rows during the priesthood meeting and Relief Society and in Sunday school, and ward coordinators were appointed. And this was a massive political machine that sprang into existence almost overnight. And my stake was very, very active in it. And every single week,
yeah,
there were coordination meetings after the 3-hour block. Parts of, as I say, priesthood meeting devoted to this. And the things that I started hearing from people in my ward and from other wards, the myths, the rumor mongering, the scare tactics, the horror stories that they would raise their hand and spread, were just shocking. I couldn't believe the level of ignorance that I was hearing about this issue. And because by then I'd started thinking, this is probably what I am. I don't know that I can really hide this from myself anymore. And, people would try to say, we should, now that you're divorced, we should set you up with this or that person, and I would say, thank you very much for your concern. And I'd say, yeah, right. No. No, yeah. never happening again. Yeah. And I slowly started getting comfortable with the idea that, maybe I need to face this. And so when I heard these people say all these things, I thought, they're talking about me. I don't want to destroy families. I don't want to destroy civilization. I don't want to, recruit impressionable young people. I've studied Roman history, and it wasn't a tolerance of homosexuality that caused the downfall of the Roman Empire. It fell 150 years after the Christians took over, and they were persecuting the gay people by then. So all that claptrap spread by Spencer Kimmel about that, I knew it was utter rubbish.
Yeah,
but that's what everybody here believed, and I thought, oh my goodness, these people—they haven't a friggin' clue what they're talking about. They have no idea what they're trying to punish or who they're going to hurt.
Yeah,
and I remember one meeting, one very, very brave visitor raised her hand and she said, I just got to say this. I teach English in a public high school, and for some reason, I get kids coming to me all the time. They seem to think that I'm trustworthy, and they unburden themselves to me in private, and I've had quite a few gay kids come to me since this campaign started, and they're in tears because they think that this means the entire state of California and all the churches are going after them, and then they're going to punish them and persecute them and discriminate against them, and they're confused. They don't know why this is happening. They feel attacked, and it's bad enough for them culturally as it is, but this thing is going to make their lives so much worse, and they're crying in fear and shame because of what they think this represents. She said, and I just want everybody in this room to know that this is the impact this is going to have. And nobody paid any attention to her. You know, other people, you know, they said, thank you very much. And then they continued talking about, you know, organizing and, you know, how the gays were going to destroy civilization and all the rest of this stuff.
Yeah.
So I ran after her in the hall afterward, and I said, I thought that was very brave of you. And I just want you to know that you're not the only one that understands that, that realizes it. And she started to cry herself. And she said, thank you so much for telling me. I felt so alone in there. I thought nobody ever would understand. And I said, well, I do.
Yeah.
So it wasn't long after that that I began talking on the phone with a friend of mine who lives in another state. And he, you know, straight guy, happily married, and we talked politics a lot, and we started talking about this. And just over time, I found myself really defending the position of gay people who wanted to get married and just wanted the same legal rights and privileges for their relationships as everybody else. I mean, I knew by then, because I actually started studying this, the whole issue of comparative therapy and changing orientation and stuff. I started looking at that. And I could tell pretty easily that it's junk science.
So for a while you thought you might apply that to yourself, you mean?
No, I never seriously considered doing it because I knew deep down that this was nothing I ever chose and it was nothing I could ever change. I knew it was ridiculous to try. I mean, I had been doing everything that people like Dr. Jeffrey Robinson in Provo, who makes his living telling stories about running away from the dragon. I read his stuff. I'd been doing everything all my life that he said would, should work.
Yeah.
And it didn't. So I knew for myself that it was a load of, you know what, it didn't work. So I never even seriously considered trying it. And I realized that gay people just wanted to be allowed to take on the very same responsibilities that the Mormon Church itself encourages everybody to do, except if you're gay.
Yeah.
I thought, what is wrong with allowing that? These people are asking to behave responsibly. They're asking to be allowed to make commitments to each other and to go away from all of these, you know, these social pathologies that are otherwise the only avenues left to them. Like the clubbing and the drugs and the, you know, the STDs and all the rest of that stuff.
Yeah.
They want to leave that behind. They want to be just as committed and just as stable as everybody else. And we're going to deny this to them in the name of religion. Why? Why does that work? Show me how that benefits anybody. You know, the Savior said, by their fruits you shall know them. And I don't see any bad fruits from allowing these people to commit to each other. And so I said this to my friend. You know, more and more stridently as he objected and objected and objected. And finally, we had like 3 or 4 phone calls on this. And finally, after the third phone call, I was standing in front of my mirror shaving the next day. And I thought, you know, I'll bet I could come out to him and I would be safe. Never, ever in my life had I ever actually thought of telling anybody. And I'd read stories by people who talked about when they came out and how liberating it was. And I thought, this can't possibly be true. This has got to be, you know, overinflated or exaggerated. And as soon as I said that to myself, I thought, I got to do it.
And you would never come to another soul, another person,
in my life.
Bishop, nobody.
Nobody. I had been so scared and so cowed. And had that drummed into my head so deeply, this sense of responsibility that you must never do this. You know, it took a long time for me to get to that point where I finally said, yes. So it was like changing my major back in college. Same pattern. That I can't. This is the point of decision. I can't do this anymore. What somebody else has told me to do, I have to make my own decision based on what I know is right for me.
Yeah.
And so as soon as I said that to myself, I thought, I got to do it. I'm going to do it. There's no question. I just knew. There's no question. I was going to do this the next day. And I was so scared. I was excited and frightened all at the same time to do this thing that I had been told would be spiritually fatal. But I was going to do it. I didn't care anymore. I was going to tell him. And so we had this call the next day. And I said, I just want you to know that, by the way, this is why I feel this way. Because I'm gay. And I understand what the people who want these marriage rights, I understand how they feel. And he said, oh, okay. Well, thanks for telling me. Now I understand better. I thought, what? That's it? That's it? You know, the sky didn't fall. You know, there's no earthquake that I felt. You know, the building didn't collapse around me. You know, I didn't hear the thunder and, you know, clouds gathering and lightning strike.
He didn't rebuke you or hit you, slug you from a distance like yeah. Who said you should slug Boy K. Packer? He didn't.
Right.
He didn't do the best thing for you, which was to hit you, huh?
Yeah, well, he was half a continent away, so
well, he could have done
it. I felt it was safe.
A sort of a verbal hit.
And so we ended the call, and I slumped back into my chair, and it was like, I can't believe this. You know, I suppose it would be like almost like what Joseph Smith described in the, you know, in the Grove, you know, the heavens open, the light comes down, because honestly, that's how it felt. I when I got it from that chair, I mean, I literally felt like I had lost about 100 pounds.
Yeah.
It was the most amazing thing ever. I couldn't believe it. I literally felt physically lighter, like I could hardly touch the ground. And for days after, this didn't fade. I mean, I would literally just break into laughter spontaneously at the sheer sense of relief.
Wow.
That finally I had had the courage to face this and to acknowledge it. And I pray that never goes away, that memory never fades, because it was just miraculous.
Yeah. Well, an awakening.
Yeah, definitely.
So you opened Pandora's box. You told a person.
Yeah.
Did it open Pandora's box?
Well, you know, how do you go back after that? So,
yeah.
So, of course, what did I instantly do? Well, I thought, am I the only one like this? I can't be. I can't be the only one like this. So, you know, you go to Google, right? And I started searching. And I think I ignored work for about 2 or 3 days, pretty much. Because it didn't take me that long to realize that there were so many others out there like me. There were blogs, there were Facebook pages, there were chat rooms, I was just astonished at how much was out there already. How many other guys like me out there talking about it, meeting each other, working through issues, dealing with the whole, you know, being gay and being Mormon thing. It was like Christmas times 1,000.
Yeah.
To find that I wasn't alone.
Were you finding gay Mormons or were you finding just gays in general?
Just gay Mormons.
Just gay Mormons, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I knew that the whole gay world was out there, but I it was just too vast to comprehend at that point. I was just going one step at a time. And so I just was stunned by how many others there were already out there, already talking about it, you know, already being very open. And I was just giddy with, you know, the prospect of actually meeting other people like this.
Yeah.
So I started reaching out online, you know, I started blogging, and it was amazing, just amazing. I made so many friends. My blog got to a point where I was getting like 1,500 hits a month.
Well. Do you still have it?
No, I shut it down a while.
Oh.
because the blog was fueled by the angst of trying to reconcile the gay and the Mormon thing. And
okay.
when I finally reached my conclusions, it had served its purpose.
Okay. But you did the quintessential, what do we call it? The tens? No, the what's the first decade of the 2000s called?
What, the millennial thing?
Well, there's a decade which we can't call the tens or the noughts. Okay. You did the quit. What do people call that? Do we have some sort of consensus? Okay. You did the quintessential thing for the noughts for a Mormon gay guy who's coming out to do, which was to connect with the blog by blogging, which is kind of a unique sort of phenomena that probably kind of might have passed its time. But you know, I hear that, that a lot of people sort of found that a way of dialoguing and connecting about that issue and sort of became a lifesaver for a lot of people. And people had their stories out there and accessible to other people. And so that was sort of contributed to the current zeitgeist and that's going on right now in the Mormon community about the relative visibility of gay people within Mormonism. And so it's kind of cool that you were part of that. And it sounds like it served a role for you that was pretty important.
Very, very much so. It really was a lifesaver because I found that there weren't actually that many guys like me here real close to where I am. So it really was a lifesaver to be able to reach out literally across the world.
Yeah.
And talk to other people. And that time has led to some of the most amazing experiences and friendships of my whole life, including the summer of 2010, when I was in Massachusetts. I actually was honored by the requests of 8 friends to perform their 4 marriages, all of them gay Mormon, gay former Mormon guys.
Wow.
5 of them had served missions. All of them got married in Massachusetts that summer. And I was asked to perform all 4 of those weddings.
Wow.
So I subsequently wrote about that. A friend of a friend of a friend, you know, heard about it. And I wrote a couple of pieces about that experience for a national, you know, online gay magazine. And so that was pretty amazing.
Yeah. But meanwhile, let's go back just a little bit and then sort of put it into the context of your journey with your... that you were also going on at the same time with your relationship with Mormonism.
Okay. As I was blogging, one of the main themes was, how do I write intimates? I've learned since that this is very paradigmatic, very, very normal. How do I reconcile these 2 things? How can I be gay and how can I be Mormon? Is there a way to do this successfully? And I wrestled for a long time with that. And let me give you an example of sort of how I was thinking in a slightly different but similar context, sort of as a story to explain how I was thinking. Because I had worked in the temple for a lot, I knew the history of the endowment and how the ceremony and the text had changed significantly over time. I knew that there were multiple versions of it since, you know, going back to Brigham Young, who was really the first one to regularize the text and the ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
And I had always accepted without question that, you know, the endowment is something that, you know, every person who has ever lived has to have the opportunity to accept in order to have maximum chance for exaltation in the celestial kingdom. And that if God is, you know, universally loving and loves all his children equally, as I think Christianity requires us to believe, that, in fact, is the premise for all of the proxy work for the dead done by the LDS Church, because everybody has to have an equal chance, right?
Right.
So that's the philosophical basis for this whole enterprise. So everybody's got to have an equal chance. So logically, that means that everybody has to have the chance to receive the same priesthood ordinances. That means, in turn, that the ordinances at their core have to be the same for everybody. That means, in turn, that there must be some irreducible essence to the endowment that will never change. Because if that's not true, then that means God is letting some people get in under some circumstances, but not others. And that we can't allow.
Right.
So, therefore, what, I asked myself, is the fundamental, irreducible core of the endowment? Well, interesting question. Because, I'd read the history. I'd read the book by Gary, what's his name, I've forgotten, called Mysteries of Godliness. Fascinating stuff about the history of Mormon temple ceremonies. You know, a lot about the second anointing and all the rest of that stuff. And I read the texts of the different versions of the endowment that are available on the internet, and saw how the oaths and the ceremonies had changed over time. The oaths, the penalties, you know, the oath of vengeance about Joseph Smith, you know, that was taken out in the 1920s, I think. And I thought, wow, well, you know, this has really changed a lot. What amongst all of this window dressing, amongst all this, you know, all these the changing in the presentation, what is the irreducible core? What is the essence that everybody has to have? I can understand why the presentation and the packaging might change, you know, as time and culture fluctuate. But what's the irreducible core that everybody has to have? And as best I could figure out, it was those four covenants. Because everything else seemed subject to change, and in fact had changed to some extent over time.
So you mean consecration, obedience,
right, kinds of chastity, and the law of the gospel. Those four things. So I thought about those words of those covenants, and I thought, you know, every one of those things, the words of the covenant, the behavioral standards, every one of those things is straight from the scriptures. And everybody can choose to behave that way, regardless of whether they take an oath in the temple to do so. The words are right there in everybody's standard works. So,
including non-Mormons, or?
Yeah.
Okay, so in everybody's Bible.
Well, no, actually.
You said standard works.
The law of consecration, the last one, you know, is pretty specific that you consecrate everything to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So for that, yeah, I guess you would have to be baptized. I mean, because you probably would do that, logically. But everything else, you know, you can do without ever going to the temple.
Yeah.
So I thought, I feel like I've just finished peeling the onion. And what's in the middle? Nothing. There's no irreducible core that's not available somewhere else. That was a very pretty stark realization for me. Because if that's the case, I think my logic is pretty solid, then, well, why did I need to go there? Why was this ordinance even necessary? So then I thought, okay, you know, I'm hearing all this stuff from LDS leaders about the so-called gay agenda and all of these things that are going to happen that are terrible and awful if Proposition 8 doesn't pass, and how children are going to be indoctrinated, and how religious freedom is going to be infringed and taken away, and how, you know, we might be compelled to perform these marriages in our temples and all this sort of thing. I heard people like Dallin Oaks and David Bednar, you know, sounding the alarms about this kind of stuff, and I thought, you know, that doesn't sound right to me. So I watched one presentation by David Bednar on YouTube with a group of adoring institute students, and it obviously was a staged interview. And I heard him say a lot of this stuff about what would happen if Proposition 8 didn't pass. And I thought, wait a minute, that can't be right. Can't be right. He was quoting references to legal cases in, you know, various places around the country. I thought, well, I'm a lawyer. I can check this out. So I literally made my own transcript of every single word that Bednar said in that interview, word for word. I wrote it all down. And then I went and researched every single claim that he made about what would happen. Now, he is speaking initially in his role as a representative of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a man that I have been taught to sustain as a prophet, seer, and revelator, speaking for the church.
Yeah.
And he's saying all this stuff. Okay, so that's fine, all right? He's put it out there. I'm going to check it out. So I went and researched all this, and on multiple points, I found that not only was he wrong or had skewed the facts, but in fact, he just flat out lied. This guy that I had been taught to reverence as a representative of Jesus Christ was lying in public.
Is there something you could give me an example that's obvious that he wasn't just believing what he was saying?
Well, this is, 4 years ago now? I can't recall exact facts or details. He referenced, I think, a case in New Mexico involving wedding photographers, and then another one where some parents in Massachusetts had tried to pull their kids out of a school because they didn't like a curriculum or something along those. He seemed to reference those cases and said, if you know, and then I believe he did say something like, we fear that we will be forced to perform these marriages, you know, our religious freedom will be lost because we will be forced to perform these marriages in our temples. And I thought, you know, I've read the California Supreme Court's decision. It is clear that that never happened. Absolutely not. That's just wrong. The church will never be forced to do that. We've never been forced. Before 1978, church was never forced to perform, you know, to admit, you know, African Americans, you know, to the priesthood or, you know, or anything like that. It just didn't happen. It can't. It won't. But here was Bednar saying, yes, this is going to happen.
But do they write their own speeches? I mean, in a publicly released kind of YouTube like this, does he even write his own speech? I mean, when my grandfather was general authority, he did write his own speeches, but they had to be highly, you know, they had to go through correlation committee before he could present them at general conference and stuff. And I don't, but that was a long time ago. I don't know how it
all
is
the
now.
More, I think they are just as highly as, probably just as vetted now as they were then through correlation, but all the more reason, Daniel. Either he knew that he was skewing and spinning, in which case, shame on him, or he didn't know, and he was just fed this stuff by what is otherwise a very sophisticated
PR machine,
bureaucracy
we know that exists.
That should have known,
right?
And certainly could have known what the truth was, but chose not to tell him, in which case, shame on the church.
Yeah.
So when I looked at the facts and I saw what he said, and I thought, this guy's lying. He's just flat out lying. I thought, that was it. That was another turning point for me. I thought, I can't trust these guys anymore. And it wasn't long after that a friend of mine said, you know, you ought to read Grant Palmer's book, An Insider's View of Mormon Origins. And so I read it on one Saturday, start to finish. I went to the library, I found it, and I sat down and I read it cover to cover. And the thesis of Grant Palmer's book, and he spent a lifetime as a church education system employee. He's done research. You're probably familiar with the book.
I haven't read it.
Okay, but a lot of listeners may not be.
It's obviously a very important piece that impacts a lot of people who are concerned about historical issues.
Right. And Palmer spent his life working for the church, had access to a lot of, you know, archives and such that most, you know, church members don't. And after this 30-year career working for CES, wrote this book.
So I read Palmer's book, and, you know, this guy had the benefit of a lifetime of study, far more intensive and far more fact than I did. And his conclusions were, based on his years of research, he said something to the effect of, the evidence used to support many traditional LDS claims about the church and its historical validity and its authority and so forth were either, quote, in his words, either problematic or non-existent. I learned about the history of the Book of Abraham and how that book does not in the slightest, the original papyri since rediscovered, have absolutely no connection whatsoever to Joseph Smith's translation of them, that translation is a complete fabrication. I learned about the DNA testing that almost, I think, overwhelmingly indicates that there is no Hebrew DNA whatsoever in Native Americans, that they are from Asia, not from the Middle East. I learned a lot of stuff about the origin of the Book of Mormon, how Smith didn't even use the plates at all. I read things about the three witnesses and about the eight witnesses, and my own ancestor being one of the three witnesses. This was of particular interest to me, that the testimony of the witnesses was far less objective and far more influenced by Smith and far less dependent on what we would call actual experience and much more on just what we'd now call imagination than I had ever realized before. I did not know that the reason we don't have a date for the Melchizedek priesthood restoration, like we do for the Aaronic priesthood restoration, is that Smith's accounts of these events date from years after they were alleged to have occurred, and he never specified a date for the Melchizedek priesthood restoration, and in fact didn't even talk about it until years afterward, during a time when apparently he was facing a leadership crisis and needed to shore up his authority amongst the church membership. I learned about the different versions of the first vision, which are all contradictory. And so I read all this, and against a backdrop of what I had just recently concluded was flat-out misrepresentations by members of the Quorum of the Twelve. I got up from that chair, and I thought, I'm done. I can no longer trust this organization on anything. I can't trust its current leaders to tell the truth about this issue that affects me so deeply. Apparently, I can't trust its prior leaders to tell the truth about why the church is allegedly true, because the evidence strongly suggests, to me at least, that it is not.
So this, you're not the first one to have, major concerns about the historicity, but I want to put it in the context of your, of this other development in your life, which was your blogging and your self-acceptance. Right. And so was this just really coinciding?
These were on parallel tracks. Uh-huh. And once I got up from that chair, as I said, and finished Palmer's book, I knew it was only a matter of time before I would resign my membership.
But you were still attending?
I was sort of semi-active. I wasn't going all the time. Uh-huh. It had gotten more and more difficult to go. Proposition 8 passed, and
now some people actually find Grant Palmer's book helps them stay in the church, but for you it was sort of.
For me it was the opposite. Remember, even back when I was a little kid, apparently according to my mom, I was always asking very probing, penetrating questions, and I ran away from that very emotionally laden, missionary testimony meeting, I think, because it was so saturated with emotion. And I've since concluded, at the expense of what I would have considered substance, I think that's when I started to figure out why I had reacted that way all those years ago. Feelings aren't facts. And the Mormon Church is virtually unique today in that so many of its foundational claims to authority and historicity actually can be verified and tested with available evidence in a way that you can't do with a lot of traditional Christianity because it's so recent in time.
Right.
And so, me being, the lawyer, I applied the tools of analysis that I had taught. And to the evidence. Okay, show me the evidence. If this is true, then the evidence should verify the feelings, because feelings don't change truth. They don't change facts. Feelings come and go. They are very subjective, and they are subject to confirmation bias and all neurochemistry and all kinds of unpredictable factors.
Now, had you had a conversion experience that you were now undoing somehow, or did you have a certain date when you were young where you sort of recognized some sort of experience that people consider a confirmation?
I had done the test Moroni's promise thing, and I felt the warm feeling and all that stuff, and I wanted it to be true, and so I felt like that was it. At that time, I had never heard of this thing called confirmation bias, and I didn't recognize that as a pattern. But subsequently, as I continued to learn about all this stuff, I realized that in fact it was a classic example of that, wanting it to be true and therefore, sort of a self-fulfilling thing.
Yeah.
But I realized that, no matter how fervently I wanted it, I might have wanted it to be true, there was no way that those feelings could explain away the fact that DNA evidence deduced by people who really have no vested interest in whether the Book of Mormon is true or not. They just say what it is. say that, you know, Native Americans are Asiatic. You know, they're from Asia. They're not Hebrew.
From East Asia, specifically.
Right, right. It can't change the fact that what Joseph Smith repeatedly called his translation of the Book of Mormon papyrus is a complete fabrication and has nothing to do with the actual papyrus.
Yeah.
And he did that under the rubric of prophetic ability. And it's been canonized by the church. You know, something that, in my opinion, is demonstrably fraudulent is now Mormon scripture. And so, you know, feelings can't change these things. And so if I'm forced to choose between feelings and facts, I'm going to go with the facts.
Okay, well, that's, you know, there's plenty of stuff written and talked about in forums
I know you want to get back to how this affects my life story. And so the reason this was important for me was that it resolved the question of how do I reconcile being gay and Mormon. And it answered the question for me by saying, A, you can't. There is no way that the concept of homosexuality can fit into Mormon theology, because if God loves everyone and everyone has to have an equal chance, that means everyone has to be equally capable of a heterosexual marriage in a temple. And I know that this is something about myself I can't change. I don't want it to change. In fact, I can't imagine not being me with this anymore. And if this is what I want, and marriage to a woman is not my idea of a future that I want, so if this is how I am, if this is how I was created, then I don't fit. I don't fit this model. I can't be made to fit this model. So many of my friends say the same thing. No, thank you. We don't want it. Doesn't fit. This means either there's a gap in Mormon theology that it hasn't yet filled and can't explain, or it means Mormon theology is off base. I don't have to trust it. And with all this other evidence that, from a purely factual perspective, says it's not trustworthy, at least to me, that resolved the question. I don't have to try to reconcile being gay and Mormon anymore, because everything I see here tells me that the Mormon approach and Mormon theology is A, incomplete, and B, incorrect. So I have no further obligation to try to conform myself to it anyway. I am now free of that dilemma and free to find a type of faith that really works for me as out, honest, open, gay, rock.
Yeah.
I don't have to contort myself to fit this model, this rigid model anymore, that really was making me miserable. So that's why all that is important, because that was the background for how I finally resolved that dilemma.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can relate a little bit, because I lost my belief in Mormonism prior to dealing with the issue of gay. But I have to say it made it a lot easier for me to deal with being gay, that I didn't have to, that for me it wasn't an issue, the relationship with the church. So I can certainly, you know, see how arriving to that conclusion would certainly simplify, or at least help you resolve the issue of also accepting yourself as a gay person.
Yep.
So then that hasn't been all that long, though. I mean, so you ended up sort of turning your world upside down not terribly long ago. And
so it's been a few years now, but not that long ago. Right.
And so where have you gone with it then, as far as both issues, as far as your, you know, being a gay man and also being a person who's on a journey of some sort that involves the spiritual quest for a lot of people?
Okay. Since then, I have, you know, continued to make friends both, you know, in and out of the LDS church. That's been, you know, it's been really good. It's been a very healthy thing, for me. I've dated and, you know, done all that normal stuff.
Yeah.
And that's been really good. It's been a real confidence builder, because for so much of my life, it was something that I never even imagined was possible.
Yeah.
And it's been wonderful. As far as the faith journey goes, well, like I said, I'd always loved, the high church type, liturgy and trappings and all that kind of stuff. And even while I was still struggling with the early days of the divorce and still being closeted, I found the Episcopal Cathedral here did a traditional Christmas service that I loved. I'd seen it on PBS from some English cathedral, and then I found that the cathedral here in San Diego does the same thing. And so I thought, oh my gosh, I can actually see this live. So I dragged the kids to it. And it was marvelous. It's just beautiful. It's just outstanding music in a beautiful, beautiful big, church with stained glass and all the stuff that I had always secretly loved and felt sort of deprived of in a Mormon setting. And over time I had made some friends there. And so when I finally resigned my membership in the LDS Church on principle, and I probably should tell you a little bit about that too, because it was a good experience. I visited with the senior pastor, the dean of the cathedral there, and I told him my story. And I said, I'm feeling kind of rudderless at the moment. And he said, well, you've been coming here for a little while now. Please, you feel welcome to, consider joining us on, and this is what he said that struck me. Forcefully. He said, do it on your timetable and your own terms. See if this type of Christianity works for you. We don't claim to have all the answers. This is the way we do it. Other people and other traditions find a way that works for them. He said, I dated a Mormon girl in high school. I've read the Book of Mormon. He said, I wasn't impressed. So I understand your journey. He said, we are very strongly supportive of LGBT people here. We don't make any discrimination for them. Everyone is welcome. And so I thought, wow, that's quite an approach. So I have since become part of that congregation. And it's wonderful. Lots of new friends. Just genuine, loving Christian fellowship and acceptance. I'm still working out what I, the nuts and bolts of what I, may believe theologically. But the nice thing about where I am now is that they don't quiz me on a regular basis with tests of orthodoxy, like in a temple recommended.
So you can participate even if you don't fully believe in their particular dogma.
Absolutely right. In fact, the webmaster for the cathedral's website is an atheist, and she attends all the time with her wife.
Okay. So they don't require rigid belief in the Bible or something to be a member of that particular Christian congregation.
There are study groups, and there's a theologian in residence, and they have adult education classes and Sunday school and all kinds of resources and stuff for developing spirituality and faith and knowledge of the scriptures and stuff. But there are no tests of orthodoxy of belief. No.
And so I have another question about it. Then, since we were talking earlier about being the pariah, you didn't have too much experience being the pariah as a gay man that some people do, but you certainly had the experience of being a pariah as a divorced man. Mm-hmm. And so now that you have another experience in a different community, do you think you would have advice about you already told me that you don't think the church will change, but do you have advice about how people might change within the wards of Zion too, so that based on your experience in a different community of how to interact with people with different family structures than your own?
I think this issue presents a challenge for rank and file conservative American Mormons, because it challenges them to break away from the correlated, authorized groupthink, which has so predominantly
driven Mormon curriculum over the last, say, 20 or 30 years. It forces them to look at people that are fundamentally different from themselves, and it tests their ability to be Christ-like. A lot of them think that they are that by saying, "Oh, this is a temporary, you know, mortal affliction that has to be fought with and struggled with and overcome." I think they probably do that in innocent good faith, trusting their leaders who teach them to say that, and they don't realize. And my own extended family is an example of this. They don't realize how exclusionary and how patronizing that is, because it's sort of, you know, a smile on the mouth but a kick in the back, a kick in the ass. It reinforces that people who are gay are people to be pitied and considered less than, and that's not what we want. We are not less than. We don't want pity. That's offensive. We want to be simply treated. We want it to not be an issue at all. We want it to be so unremarkable that it just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And so, anyone,
well, let me put it this way: I want
Mormon,
pity,
Mormon, Presbyterian, Catholic, or whatever. That's what they should try for.
Yeah, I mean, I would put it this way: if you're going to give pity to a gay person, give pity for how they're treated.
Yes,
know, that's where.
That's right.
We would welcome the pity, but not the pity for what we are.
That's
but,
right.
Anyway,
a very, very, very smart friend of mine, just a brilliant artist and very, very talented writer. A former LDS guy, also gay, put it this way. He said, the way that the Mormon Church and a lot of other conservative Christian churches treat gay people is like beating someone until they bleed and then beating them for bleeding.
Yeah.
It's not the being gay that's the problem. It's
that you're being beaten up for being gay.
How you're treated.
Right.
That's right.
Well, so why don't you mentioned your resignation story that you said you wanted to share.
Yeah, when I finished Palmer's book and I realized that I could no longer in good conscience remain part of this organization. It was just a matter of time. And so like the rest of it, I just waited until the time was right. And then I sent in my resignation letter. And I resigned on, and I explained that I had resigned on principle while I still held a temple recommend. It was not that I wanted to go off and dive headfirst into sin and debauchery or anything like that. I knew that I could no longer continue as a part of this organization or this history. And so, in addition to the regular resignation letter, I also included a side letter to my bishop and my stake president, both of whom are lawyers. And I told them that if they wanted to meet with me privately just to talk about this and to hear, you know, some parts of my story that they didn't know before, I'd be happy to do that, happy to visit with them. And they both eagerly accepted. And they are wonderful guys, both of them. And I met one-on-one with the bishop first and then with the stake president. And they were very respectful. Neither one of them gave me even the slightest hint of criticism or opprobrium or, you know, sort of looking askance at me or raising an eyebrow. Nothing. Not a bit of it. In fact, my bishop said, you know, Rob, this issue is the single most difficult one the church faces today because we have no answers for our gay members. We don't know what to do with this issue. And that's a difficult position for this church that, you know, that's so focused on having the truth and knowing things, not just believing them. That's a difficult position to be in, but we don't have any answers. He said there are really only three things for gay Mormons to do. Really only three. One is be celibate. You know, he puts up, you know, finger number one. One, be celibate. And then he looks at me and says, eh, but really, I mean, come on, be real. You know, be realistic. Come on.
Right.
Two, he says, marry someone of the opposite sex and just sort of grit your teeth and try to white knuckle it through and hope it works. And I said, yeah, done that. He said, and even the church, of course, has no longer tells people to do that because it realized but that was disastrous, and it didn't work. And the third option, he said, is leave the church and do your best to live an authentic, honest life, you know, in accordance with the best principles of morality that you can. Those are the three options for gay Mormons.
Might I throw in, though, that there are some people who are really feel like there's a fourth option, which is to accept whatever status they decide to throw at you, whether it be resignation or, I'm sorry, whether it be excommunication or sort of active in a limited way, but who maintain church participation but do have relationships that would be considered gay and against the church, or would be considered officially against the church policy, but they continue participating in that context. So that's sort of the fourth option.
Yes, that is, I agree with you. There are some people that do that. I think the premise for both his opinion and mine, as well as my conclusions, were that with all due respect to the choices made by those people, you cannot be in full fellowship and exercise all the full privileges of LDS membership and do what they do.
Right.
They have still made fundamental, significant compromises for their own life in right. order to try to keep that oil and that water together.
Right.
And personally, I'm not interested in that.
Yeah.
So I think that was the premise for his statement. So at the end of our visit, he said, Rob, I really want to thank you for coming in and talking to me. He said, I appreciate your sharing all that. He said, I want to thank you for your years of service to the church. And he said, I hope we can remain friends. And he said, I wish you the very best. And that was that. And we have remained friends. And then I went and visited with the stake
president. But let's talk about that a minute. But what was beautiful about that was he just was honest about mm-hmm. really acknowledging that the only place that was available for you in the church was really untenable, even in his opinion. And
correct.
So he couldn't possibly criticize you for choosing to leave based on his own evaluation and him being a bishop, that this was really the reality for gay people.
Right. Plus, I leveraged the fact that we were both lawyers, and I put it in terms that I knew a lawyer would understand. I said, look, when I was baptized and I went to the temple, I made a contract. And it's now become clear to me that my life is not going to go in a direction in which I can fully honor that contract.
Yeah.
And so as a matter of integrity, I choose to notify the other party to the contract, that is you and the church, that I wish to terminate while I'm still in compliance with the contract's requirements. I don't wish to just blatantly breach. I don't want to make choices that could be criticized as possibly in violation of the contract and still claim to try to adhere to it, as you've just alluded to, as some people try to do. I personally can't do that. And so I wish to terminate the contract as a matter of ethics while I'm still in compliance with it. And so that's what I've done.
Okay.
I explained it in the same way to the stake president. I told him the whole story. It took about an hour. And he said virtually nothing. He just sat there and looked at me very intently, watched me and listened to what I said. And one time when I told him what the bishop said about those three choices, and he nodded, he said, yes, that's correct. And then when I finished the story, his first reaction really surprised me. He said, well, Rob, I can tell you this. He said, there is a remarkable change in your countenance now. You have a glow about you that I have not seen before. He said, it is very noticeable. And I thought, isn't that interesting? No, this is a stake president. And I've just finished telling him the reasons why I have left the church. And he says, Rob, you look better than you ever have. Interesting. I thought, well, now that tells me I made the right choice.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that too, frankly, because he had to open up his mind a little bit to let this into his head that maybe it's better for some people to be outside the church. And, you know, sure, as a gay person, you know, I don't have a lot invested in me personally being allowed to be a Mormon because I don't believe there now. But but I'm thinking about the message that are given to our children. And yes, I'd rather they just had full equality. But if they're not going to be given full equality, I would sort of take this as a second consolation that, yes, you're invited to leave. Let's leave on good terms. Let's leave with good relationships. Let's leave with respect. Let's part ways. I mean, it's still kind of an ostracization, but at least it's an ostracization that is a lot more affirming. And so I'm... You know, I give kudos to your stake president and your bishop who sort of framed it that way, that they can't place it upon themselves to judge you for this decision. That seems like the best decision. So all they can do is wish you well. And I presume they would have wished that you could maintain good relationships with your family, with your Mormon friends, and still feel part of the Mormon community if you happen to live in a very Mormonly dense place, right?
Right.
Which you don't, but... so anyway, I think that's a great thing that they did in that
I was very impressed, and I happened to be sort of casually acquainted a little bit friends with a member of the presidency of the First Quorum of 70 still, and I spent an hour visiting with him last summer, and I told him this story. And I gave him the names of my stake president and bishop specifically because he was very, very pleased to hear how they had handled this situation.
Yeah.
And I said, this does these men and the church great credit. This is how it should work.
Yeah.
I've heard lots of horror stories of people that didn't have a similar experience. Right. And I felt very fortunate. The stake president said, I will remain friends. I hope you'll still come over to practice the organ on Tuesday nights, he said, because I love hearing you play.
And did you?
I have, yes, but he hasn't been there when I went. But
That's nice then. You can still at least sort of enter a chapel door without feeling, because, you know, there's a part of you that's still Mormon, even if you can't let go of all of our history, right? It's still our heritage.
I can't change the background, that's for sure. But the last time I went there, actually, I had gone through I was cleaning out a closet, and I found some music that belonged to the ward choir. And so I walked over on a Sunday when I knew that my old ward would be ending to give this back to the choir director at the end of the block when I knew that she would be available. And I walked into the building again, and it had been quite a while since I'd been there. And I was in, I think, like khaki shorts and a polo shirt or something.
Yeah.
And they and everybody. And I walked in and I started seeing all these faces of people that I remembered that I hadn't seen in quite a long time. And, you know, building was buzzing with, you know, word activity and such. And I saw a lot of people and I saw them see me. And not a single one of them even acknowledged that I was there. People that I knew, whose names I remembered, you know, who looked me in the eye and just passed on. And when I got into the Relief Society room where the ward choir was congregating, I found the choir director. She welcomed me with open arms, especially was glad to have her music back. And there was one other sister who I had since ran into in a Target store. And she saw me there and she came over and gave me a big hug again. But she walked over and she said, "Oh, you look fabulous. You look so great. It's so good to see you again. Where have you been? Why haven't we seen you? It's just so glad to see you. You look terrific," all this stuff. But everybody else, you know, I might as well not even have walked through the door. I might as well be invisible.
Yeah. What's the word for that? What the Amish do if you stop being Amish, they just...
Yeah, the shunning.
Shunning. There you go. Mm-hmm. So for some reason, it's not... preached supposedly, but this shunning phenomenon is incredible.
It sure happens, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, so you know, I'm glad you're in a good place. I mean, it sounds like you've arrived at a place you feel good about. You've got, you know, some issues going on that, you know, we're not choosing to discuss here, obviously, in your personal life, your family, your, you know.
My extended family, my father and my siblings have not taken this well.
Yeah.
They have not taken this well. They have chosen to follow what they believe is the advice of Dallin Oaks and have essentially said that if I'm going to be allowed to continue to participate in the family, then I basically have to go back into the closet.
Yeah.
And I've said, I can't do that. I'm not going to. And what you're basically doing is asking me to lie about myself in order to be accepted. And I hope you realize that that's not a healthy thing for anybody to be required to do, you know, in any group. And so we don't have a lot of contact now. I hope that someday they will change their minds, although my father, God bless his good, solid, faithful heart. He has great, great difficulty with this. He's told me he doesn't think he will ever be able to accept this. He is a wonderful and good and kind and decent and loving man. And I think this may just be more than he is equipped to deal with.
Yeah.
So, bless his heart. I wish it could be otherwise, because I see him and some of my siblings too going through a lot of pain over this that I personally think is totally unnecessary. And that hurts me, because it hurts to see someone that you love put themselves through pain that you think is unnecessary. And I wish they would be more willing to talk to me substantively about why I've made the choices that I have and why I think they don't need to feel as bad about it as they do. But they just don't seem to be ready yet.
Or if not that, how about just setting it aside and loving you as a brother?
Yeah. But that wasn't the collective decision that was communicated to me. I was told that if I wanted to continue to participate in the family, that I would have to go back in the closet. I was never to speak of this. I was never to bring up anything about this part of my life. I was never to send them anything to read about it, or never to bring it up for discussion, especially not even to think about bringing someone to any family event.
Yeah.
So those were the terms. And I said, you know, it's not going to work for me, guys.
Well, it's, you know, I'm hoping that that's going to change as things evolve in your family, because it is, I mean, seems like 3 years would be enough, but.
I hope so too, because I miss them. I miss them, but I can't, I spent most of my life with that sense of duty and responsibility and obligation, you know, forcing me to do things that ultimately prove damaging and destructive. And I'm sure that they see my choices now as damaging and destructive. I just wish that they would be willing to talk with me about why I don't believe they are. I think I could allay their fears a lot.
Yeah.
But it scares them, and because it challenges their paradigm and challenges their commitment, I think, to the brand of Mormonism that they have always believed in. And I understand that. I of all people understand how frightening this kind of a change can be. I mean, look how long it took me. Yeah, I get it.
And so you sort of have some sympathy for their stance, because you see that the way they look at Mormonism and the way you used to look at Mormonism just doesn't allow for tolerance to others in this context. And
that's
so
right.
That trumps the part that says Christ-like love, don't judge others, and empathy are all trumped by the need to maintain this particular narrative in your head, that it all holds together on this. And in a way, they aren't expecting you to be there in the celestial kingdom with them, so why should he be with them now? I mean, that's sort of harsh, but...
You know, I can't speak, obviously, to the details of what actually goes on in their head. All I can speak to is the fact that we were all raised with the same perspective, you know, on LDS teachings, and I see that perspective continue to be reflected in their lives. And so I have to assume that it continues to have the similar effects on them and their beliefs as it used to have for me. You know, that's details I can't speak to.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. Just the same, it's a tough place, and we, you know, it's also a common experience that gay people have, is that we are forced to accept this position of being seen as broken or seeing as an outsider within our own families or our own communities. And it's unfortunately sort of the minority of Mormon families who are able to manage it in such a way that they can maintain a full 100% relationship with their gay family members. I think there's more of them, more families succeeding in that. And it kind of wants me to talk about what a discussion I wanted to have, sort of a public discussion about that particular thing, because I have had some recent encounters with some of my super Mormon friends, you know, or family members. And it's taken me a long time to come to some of these discussions with them, because I always assumed the worst, which was I just assumed they would treat me as they treat everyone, because I saw it, you know, mm-hmm. which was in a judgmental way, in a non-accepting way. You know, they just see me as broken, or I lost a spirit, or I didn't have the faith, or, you know, right. I was tempted by Satan or whatever to come to this right. mm-hmm. realization. And I've had actually some beautiful experiences lately that I hope you'll have more of, but you described them with your bishop and your stake president, which was simply that there are some people who are incredibly true-believing Mormons who somehow find it within their theology or within their heart or within their version of Mormonism to look at a gay person, specifically me or another gay person, or even a divorced person or a depressed person or a person who doesn't fit into what the perfect Mormon is supposed to be. And they're able to look at them non-judgmentally and say, mm-hmm. I can't explain everything, but I don't need to judge them. I can affirm them, and I can fully accept them in my family, in my life, and I can validate and see the wonderful qualities this person has, and I do not need to judge them, and I know God will judge them fairly when it's time for God to judge them. Now, I was just talking to a friend last week who told me that's where she arrived in her relationship to Mormonism, and that the judging is not for her to do. And so, you know, I see that you've had both kinds of experiences in your encounter with Mormon family friends.
And my bishop and stake president aren't the only active members of the church that I know who are like that. I know others too. My yeah. former ward choir director being one of them. It yeah. doesn't bother her in the least. So yes, I know that this is entirely possible.
Well, so that sort of brings me to this other sort of topic that doesn't impact you specifically, except that I know you've had opinions about that, is sort of there's a group of people who are out there sort of campaigning for a grassroots change in the church. And when we say grassroots, we're talking about a cultural change. We're talking from a bottom-up change. Right. And you and I both know that bottom-up changes can conceivably impact church policy, but basically that's not where most church changes come. They're from the top down. But the question is, can there be a bottom-up change that substantially changes church culture? And when I say that I'm thinking of these people, these examples of church members I have who are really embracing the parts of Mormonism that I admire, which is Christ-like love, empathy, judge not that you be not judged. And these are the same people who would never ostracize a gay person from their ward, from their family, from their community. These are the same people who would reach out to them and who would embrace them. And I know there's bishops and stake presidents in that category, and there's bishops and stake presidents who aren't excommunicating their gay members. And so my question is, I've come to the opinion that there's something very useful for this type of efforts that a lot of people are really promoting in a high profile way, like Joanna Brooks, and you know, in different ways.
And I know Joanna, by the way.
Okay.
She lives here. We've spoken face to face at length. She's a wonderful person, and I love reading her stuff.
And so, tell me your thoughts about that. I mean, do you have a fundamental disagreement with that approach? I mean, I know you don't believe in the church, and so obviously you're not that gung-ho about defending people wanting to stay in it, and therefore you might not be that gung-ho about defending a gay person's desire to stay in it, because you might not see that as healthy. But I'm sort of like...
I've gotten into some debates online where some people have, I think innocently and perhaps somewhat hastily, mischaracterized my perspective as denying that any change in the church is ever possible. That's not quite right. For myself, personally, the equation is pretty simple. Based on the facts and the evidence and the history, I feel no obligation to believe in or go along with, you know, the LDS organization anymore. So that essentially resolves the issue for me, and I'm free to find that love and charity and non-judgmental, you know, Christianity and, you know, and fellowship, you know, in other places, and it's freely available in other places, and I've been very fortunate to find that now in the Episcopal Church. So that's how it's worked for me. For those who, for whatever reason, wish to continue affiliating with their, you know, with their Mormon upbringing, want to try to stay in the church, I have several thoughts. First of all, any effort to put into practice, you know, the second great commandment that Jesus taught, to love your neighbor as yourself, regardless of circumstance, I think is welcome and should be encouraged, regardless of church, regardless of theology, regardless of any of that stuff. And the Relief Society motto is charity never faileth. And so any effort to increase those attitudes that you've described, bring it on, by all means, welcome. Certainly long overdue in a lot of churches. Okay. From a historical perspective, I think the record is pretty clear that the Mormon Church is not susceptible to fundamental doctrinal change from the bottom up.
Right.
That has happened in a number of contexts where local programs have subsequently been adopted as church-wide programs. The primary organization, the Sunday school, the welfare program, which was first started by Harold Lee back when he was a young stake president in Idaho. Those are all examples of local initiatives back in the days pre-correlation, when local initiatives were allowed. They're not anymore. That subsequently they got some notice and they were adopted as churchwide programs. But that sort of thing, I think those days are past, because correlation keeps such a tight hold on everything now. Ironically, it was Harold Lee who started the local version of what became the churchwide welfare program that subsequently created correlation that has now basically made those kinds of efforts impossible.
But
apart from that, I think the reason why I don't see these grassroots efforts by groups like, you know, the newly respawn, you know, cozy up to the church affirmation, or, you know, other, you know, the new No More Strangers blog, or, you know, people like that. The reason why I think ultimately they will fall short of what needs to be done, I'm not saying they won't accomplish any good. I mean, God bless them for whatever good they can do to increase love and charity and understanding, you know, prevent suicides and such. I think the reason they will fall short is that what gay people ought to be interested in is full equality. And I know that there are a lot of them who will say, well, we have to get there in baby steps. And so we'll have to, you know, take it step by step at a time, you know. And so if we have, that means we have to be satisfied with crumbs from the table for a while until we can persuade people to share more. And that's what we'll do, as long as we're moving in the right direction. Okay, fine. But here's the wall you're going to run up against. Okay. And this, it was very well described to me by this same senior general authority that I visited with last summer. Okay. The LDS Church is not a democracy. And people who are at the grassroots level, who think that they can lobby top leadership, I'm sort of summarizing what he said, who think that they can lobby top leadership for a change like that, are fooling themselves. That is not how this organization works. It has never worked that way. And in fact, again, if you look at the history, the only times that the church has made such a fundamental doctrinal shift in the past has been with polygamy and with the priesthood ban. And the only things that forced the church to do that were external pressures and threats to its legal existence and its finances. That is simply not going to happen with respect to this issue because the demographics just don't support it. There simply aren't enough gay people to bring that much pressure to bear on the Mormon church to change probably the single most fundamental doctrine of its entire theology, which is the centrality of a heterosexually married male-female couple being exalted in the eternities and having an eternity of spirit children and becoming like God. That is the centerpiece of the entire structure. And to accept same-sex relationships as an equal with that, which in my opinion is the only thing worth chasing, is to ask the church to rewrite every bit of theology since the days of Joseph Smith. And I just don't see how they can do that without risking such a loss of credibility after a century of saying, this can never change. We will never change. This is the.
So you see it right there as women holding the priesthood. That it's right there in line with. Well, that. But those are two things that are never gonna.
You know, happen. But even that, I could see changing before they would allow same-sex relationships, because I've read quotes from 19th-century apostles that talk about women giving priesthood blessings, and in the temple, women perform the priesthood ordinances of the initiatory ceremonies for other women.
But there's also examples of men being sealed to men. I mean, it's not the same.
That's true, but it's not the same. That is more in my understanding, and I've read Quinn's stuff on this. It looks to me like those are very sort of fraternal, you know, family, nuclear family, brother to brother types sealings. Certainly not a spousal relationship with a sexual aspect to it. I think that goes too far. I don't see any justification for that.
But I think with correlation, one thing that's happened is that the Mormon Church, theologically speaking, is trying to downplay some of its differences from Christianity in general. And so they do have this narrative about eternal family and eternal marriage, but there's a lot of theology that we grew up with, which really isn't emphasized at all anymore.
Very true.
And all of this is overwhelmingly the theologies that are also theologies that would be considered bizarre by mainstream Christians.
Yes.
So it seems to me, you know, I'm not sitting around thinking they're going to change this in my lifetime necessarily, but I'm just putting that out there that, you know, we're on this trajectory actually with correlation of talking about these sort of simple things. And simple things, you know, you can have, it's easier to change sort of a simple explanation than it is to change this complex story that we kind of grew up with, right? This the narrative about, you know, we're not talking so much about even about the idea that we're going to become gods or that we're going to be eternal. They talk about eternal progression, but this isn't emphasized. I mean, I don't know if it's going to disappear from the collective consciousness of Mormonism. You're right.
It's not emphasized. And correlation, you're absolutely right. Again, has over time had sort of a simplifying sort of reductive effect, some people call it dumbing down, of the sort of public face of Mormonism, especially when it's presented to potential converts. But at its most fundamental level, some things haven't changed. And one of the things that haven't changed, and that, in fact, this general authority told me can't change, is, and he called it non-negotiable.
Well, is the, but non-negotiable with the current leadership who grew up with this old Mormonism, but there's going to be a new leadership who grew up with a different Mormonism.
I know that. And that in turn leads to my qualifier, which is why I haven't said publicly that the church can't possibly and never will change. What I've said is that given in this age of the internet, when the whole history is so available, and the century and more of teaching under prophetic authority, that this family model is the only one acceptable, and that goes back to the days of Joseph Smith. For the LDS Church, even at a future date, to reverse course on that and to say, now we're going to change the 132nd section. We are going to allow, we are going to bless same-sex marriages in the temple. We are going to expand our theology to say these relationships are possible in the eternities. That is so fundamentally at odds with everything the church has ever taught since its foundation that I think it would risk a huge crisis of credibility amongst the membership.
But they've done it before. They did it with polygamy.
Yes, they have. But polygamy and the priesthood ban, in my opinion, are in different categories. Okay, polygamy was not renounced and revoked and obliterated. It's all that happened was its practice was suspended. It still remains canonical, and Mormon men can still be sealed to multiple wives.
Yeah.
In that sense, it continues. It's never been revoked. As to the priesthood ban, the priesthood ban is also, I believe, dissimilar because Joseph Smith ordained Elijah Abel, a black man, to the priesthood. And so when Brigham Young instituted the priesthood ban, it was always known to scholars to be somewhat historically questionable, and it was always taught that at some future day it would be lifted. But the idea that a man and a man can be sealed together as spouses in the eternity is absolutely unknown, and not only unknown, but because of the procreative aspect, is completely impossible within the current understanding of the 132nd section and all of Mormon theology. That's why I think this issue is in a different class.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not the best person to really discuss this because I'm not a particular expert on Mormon doctrine, but what I see is a phenomena that's very different now in this part of Mormon history that has emerged in the last 20 years. Is that there is a body of Mormons who are advocating and living a change of social attitudes, a change of culture, a change of their relationship with their religion. There is a body of Mormons who want to remain Mormons, who want to live as Mormons, but who don't want to be tied down to all this stuff they disagree with. And they keep comparing themselves to Reformed Jews because Jews are identifying themselves as Jews whether or not they're Mormons. I'm sorry, geez. Jews are, whether or not they're Orthodox or conservative Reformed Jews, they all have the Jewish identity. Mormons have never had a place for that.
Right.
Where there are people who can express their Mormonism in a different way other than these fringe groups which tended to be more and more Orthodox. But
just to interject for just one quick moment, I would argue that that's absolutely correct, and that is a function of the authoritarian, centrally priesthood controlled nature of the church. It doesn't officially really even allow for that concept to exist. It's not as freeform as Judaism.
Right.
So,
but
anyway,
the difference is at some point Mormonism will reach a critical mass where there will be enough people who will put that aside and say, we are Mormons, and we are going to come to church, and we are going to participate, and we aren't going to buy into everything that's taught here. And that's what has happened, of course, to American Catholics, who are overwhelmingly in favor of gay marriage. They don't listen to the Pope. But this is a cultural change that, of course, the church is fighting big time right now.
But, well, you know the joke about the Mormons and the Catholics on that point, right?
What's that?
The Catholics say the Pope is infallible, but they don't really believe it.
Okay.
The Mormons say that their prophet isn't infallible, but they don't really believe that.
Okay. Well, there you go. But the point is there's other cultural changes that can happen in the church that are smaller. And we don't have to wait till suddenly there's this version of Reform Mormonism. There can be a Mormonism that exists and that can become more predominant. That is people who are going to embrace their gay members. And they may not be able to offer them certain things like a temple marriage, but they can certainly offer them a welcoming place in their community. And they can just sort of downplay the theological differences and make them less and less relevant in the community life of a Mormon. And that will come from what's happening. We're getting so many Mormons who are genuinely concerned about the welfare of their gay and lesbians, who do believe in marriage equality, who don't necessarily think that it's going to come into Mormonism, but they're going to go out and campaign and fight for it and vote for it, very different than what was happening in 2008. And so what I'm saying is that there's a body of Mormons who are actually believing Mormons, like my friend, like your bishop, like your state president, who would love to figure out a way to let gay people participate. And it won't be you and me, but it will be these young people who are part of this community, who are trying to interact with their families, and some of them who just want that to be their place of worship, for better or for worse, even if they're not there equally. At least I would prefer to see them be able to choose that if that's what they want to choose, without it being such a negative place for them, even if I don't agree with their reasons for wanting to be there. So that's kind of what I see happening within Mormonism, that what is happening at the center of Mormonism at, you know, Temple Square becomes less and less relevant.
And to all of that, I would say I don't think I can find anything objectionable about any of that. I say again, let's go back to what I said before, to the extent that we can increase charity and kindness and acceptance and true, you know, non-judgmental Christian love in any denomination, by all means, let's do it. Ultimately, I would not be satisfied with just that. But for people that, you know, whose priorities are different, or who, you know, see things differently than I do, if that is the place that they choose, and want to spend their time, that's the community they want to stay with, then I wish them, you know, all the success that they can find.
Yeah, and I'm not as worried about them. I'm not worried as the grown-ups who are, you know, consciously, you know, making a choice about their life. I'm also thinking about the 16-year-old and the 14-year-old
who don't have a choice and their paths easier, to reduce the suicides, to reduce the depression and the misery and the conflict, you know, internally, and the fear, and the ostracism. Yeah, whatever we can do, we should.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of why I'm doing, you know, why I'm involved in this way, you know. And there's people on the inside, even more on the inside than me, who are really doing some things that they're trying to make the agenda palatable to mainstream Mormons. And I guess it's a lot of discussion. We don't need to get into it, but there's a lot of discussion about the relative pros and cons of the new website and then movements like Mormons Building Bridges versus Mormons for Marriage Equality and movements.
Yeah, I've seen all that. and frankly, I'm kind of glad that I've stepped away from it all.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, any organization run by, you know, fallible humans is going to run into fallible human issues and problems and arguments and disagreements. You know,
well, we're a polarized bunch of people, and that's sort of the outcome of our Mormon upbringing, being such so strongly inclined in one way as your family is and as your upbringing was, that even if we step away from it, we're bound to get polarized in one way or another. That's kind of a outcome. Well, anyway, we sort of sidetracked onto a discussion that I kind of wanted to have, and But I just want to know if there's more you want to add about your experience and where you're at, and if maybe you have some thoughts about tying up where you're at and
something. There are a couple of points that I would like to make. One is I'm very grateful for the wrestling match. It was probably the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life, was to deal with that period of time from the divorce to coming out to finally realizing that I couldn't stay in the LDS Church anymore. My dad, who is a very wise man in many, many ways, I remember him telling me when I was growing up, he said, there comes a point in everybody's life when the things that you have spent your whole life to that point running away from, they will finally start to catch up with you. And I reached that point. He was right. He also said that everybody has to go through their own version of Gethsemane. And he was right on that too. So I really respect how he, I think unwittingly probably, prepared me for having to wrestle with completely turning my life upside down, completely reorienting, recalibrating everything I ever believed, everything I ever trusted, and the whole direction of my life, which was damn difficult. But the way I've explained this to a lot of people is, they say, "Well, you were raised Mormon, you were so active, you were rising in the leadership, and all this stuff, and how could you have done this? Didn't you have a testimony, and all this sort of stuff?" And I said, it's kind of like, you think of it this way. I think of myself as having been born in a boat, and this boat carried me for a lot of my life. And it carried me through some really rough times. It kept me safe, no doubt. It kept me safe from a lot of things. And I'll always be grateful for that. And then one day, the boat hit something. It hit a new continent. It hit the shore. And it couldn't go any further. It couldn't carry me any further. It was simply not designed or equipped to carry me any further. It's incapable of doing it. I had to get out. I had to get out and keep going on my own, because the boat was not capable of taking me any further. It's like that scene at the end of Shakespeare in Love. Did you see that movie?
Yeah.
Okay, you remember at the very, very end where the heroine, Viola, she goes off, she with her, with her husband, Colin Firth, whatever, the Earl of Essex, and they sail to his plantations in Virginia, and the ship wrecks. It's destroyed. She's the only survivor. At the very, very end of the movie, it shows her all by herself walking along this broad expanse of sandy beach with a forest, this whole new continent far off in the distance. She's walking toward it. It's completely unknown to her. But the boat's been shipwrecked, and she survived. And she is heading toward some completely new life somewhere. She doesn't know, but it's ahead of her. And she's fine. And that's what it was like for me. And I've also compared it to coming out of a stuffy little room. I mean, with all due respect to what I learned in Mormonism, when I left, I wondered how it would affect me. And I've been really surprised to hear so many other people say the same things about what they've realized after they left. It's affected us all in a couple of very, very fundamentally similar ways. One is, we're no longer nearly as judgmental as we were. The hierarchical, worthiness-focused, authoritarian culture of Mormonism seemed to have inculcated in us this sort of latent tendency to judge people and to categorize them, and to treat them differently according to perceived righteousness and worthiness and all the rest of that stuff. It was a hindrance to true universal Christian charity. At least it was for me. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I've realized it, you know, after the fact. And I have repented many times for being such a judgmental pastor.
Yeah.
I no longer feel that. So to that in that sense, leaving, ironically, I believe, has made me a better Christian. I've heard other people say the same thing. It's like I said, coming out of a small room, it has made this life, I don't worry so much about the next life anymore. It has made this life so much more beautiful and magnificent and awesome and full of wonder. And it's like me being Viola on that beach after I've gotten out of this little boat, and suddenly it's just like this vast expanse of eternity, you know, just stretching as far as the eye can see. That's what life feels like now, because I'm no longer required to contort myself to fit into this very, very narrow framework of worldview. And it's out there for me to explore and to find truth and what works for me. And it's the most amazing, liberating feeling. Like I've been holding my breath for decades, and suddenly I can breathe.
Yeah.
I'm not inside that little room anymore. I'm looking out into space, and I see it for the first time. It's so amazing. I never imagined it would feel like this. But, you know, if you take the Savior at his word, he said, by their fruits you shall know them. And then these moves of the last years for me have been nothing but good, because I'm no longer tormented inside. I'm no longer tortured. I'm no longer contorted. I'm honest with myself. I'm honest about myself. It's much easier for me to treat everybody with fundamental Christian love and kindness and decency, far more than it ever was before.
Yeah.
I don't judge people anymore like I used to. I just don't worry about all the same things anymore. It's so ironic, you know, leaving that place, I think in some ways deepened my faith, even as it taught me that maybe some of the stuff that I still believe maybe isn't logical, maybe doesn't have any evidence for it. But I think we're feeling people as well as intellectual people. And I have friends who have left, you know, gay Mormon friends who have left Mormonism and have become very rigorously atheistic. And I love these friends dearly. And they sometimes tease me about continuing to go to church because they think it's intellectually indefensible. Well, that's fine. It doesn't bother me. You know, if I'm just barely theistic at this point, fine. I'm still working out what I think about all of it. And where I go to church, it doesn't matter anyway. So this is a good place for me to be right now.
Well, and you feel free to be atheist at your church anyway. I mean, you...
Yeah, I can.
That's
what concept, right?
You found that you can participate for reasons other than just what your belief is. That there's more reasons for you than that to go to a church. So
that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
But there they say, whatever you feel called to do and however you feel called to contribute, and whatever makes the most sense to you, whatever you see truth to be that makes you a better person, that's what we welcome. And we're not going to quiz you about it.
Yeah. Well, Rob, so I sure appreciate your time, and we interview people here from a wide range of perspectives, and so I think a lot of our listeners may not find they agree with everything you say, but we have a lot of important discussions that are worth anyone thinking about, and that was nice for us to get a chance to do that.
Here's one thing that I particularly like, just in closing, about the Episcopal tradition. And one of the reasons that I think, I don't know that I would fit in any other Christian denomination other than this one. They teach there that the Episcopal Anglican tradition is like a three-legged stool. The three legs are faith, tradition, and reason. All three are equally important, and they in fact value disagreement and even dispute as a means for people to share different perspectives and discover more truth. So if people disagree with anything I've said here, I expect that. Fine. Bring it on. That's why I welcome the opportunity to talk with you, because knowing that you and I don't see eye to eye, but I'm not afraid of that. This is exchanging ideas. You know, truth can stand on its own, and exchanging ideas like this without fear and without agenda, this is how we all learn.
Yeah. Well, we have an agenda, which is increase the Christ-like love.
Yes, that's
this
true.
Is the okay. agenda we share, and that agenda yes. goes towards improving the situation for the gay Mormons who are over there. That's kind of why we're doing this, talking.
Okay.
And
that agenda, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. that's important.
But I admit, but I agree. That's the only agenda that to me is, you know, that I'm really holding to, at least within the context of this project, and so. And that's sort of consistent with what you tell me you're feeling strongly about. So I guess in the end, we do agree on what's important.
Good.
Along with your bishop and stake president. So
yes, they are.
We are a big tent, after all.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see the podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation today at GayMormonStories.org. Music for this podcast was graciously donated by Nabby Parkinson Folk and Ricky Parkinson.
That thou hast shown pause to help and lift another, finding strength beyond my own. Savior, to judge.